On this week's 51%, we look back at one of the women's marches and hear from the founder of a nonprofit that trains women journalists in the developing world.
In part because of the way mainstream media covers women in the developing world, right? There is a dominant, almost sole victim narrative when it comes to who are women in Africa, who are women in rural Guatemala.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. And all right. On January 20th, in cities around the world, women demonstrated for the second straight year. 51%'s Patrick Garrett reports.
It was a brisk early Saturday morning when I boarded the bus with the League of Women Voters of Saratoga County. The air hurt, but was filled with the smell of house-prepared drip coffee and the anxious mood you'd come to expect from the new wave of marches around America. Every single seat was filled. The excitement, palpable. 3 hours later, we would arrive in New York City, where the energy would increase with every block. We hadn't started marching yet, but the simple stroll to Central Park West, where the crowd would eventually line up, already had its fair share of observers outside the fenced-in area. We arrived around 11 a.m., and the march was due to start around 1 p.m., 2 more hours in the cold. But no one seemed to even notice. Then the march started. Last year, singer-songwriter Milk's song Quiet went viral when she and a crowd of women at the Washington, D.C. march sang a cappella. This year, she performed at the Women's March in NYC.
I can't keep quiet no more. I can't keep quiet no more.
The Saratoga group started marching just after 1. It took a little over 2 hours to reach the Midtown stopping point. In that time, we passed 2 of President Donald Trump's properties, which inevitably attracted small pockets of protesters. Rally chants and protest signs lined the streets, calling out the president on the first anniversary of his inauguration. Others showed up to protest the Women's March, but many in the march would not give them the attention they were looking for. The entire journey and the crowd of an estimated 120,000 people had the energy of a rock concert. If a rock concert had more politics. But supporters say that's what makes this special. It's not a rock concert. It's the Women's March. Ann Krill, co-president of the League of Women Voters of Saratoga County, said it's important to try to make a difference.
I have felt for a long time that things in the world are not going the way I would like to see them, and I have to make a difference. I have to leave the world a better place somehow, and for my children. I'm retired now, and I have the time, and I have to use this time as long as I can to try and make a difference.
For 51%, I'm Patrick Garrett.
And just a warning, there is a reference to a sexual act in this interview that may not be appropriate for some listeners. Christy Hegrinus wanted to be a foreign correspondent since she was 6 years old. Within days of achieving her dream job, she realized she was the wrong person for it. Who are the right people? The women who actually live in the countries usually covered by outsiders. So she decided to train women journalists and give them a platform to tell the stories of their own communities. To change the story, you have to change the storyteller. KALW's Inflection Point host Lauren Schiller spoke with Christy Hegrinus, founder and executive director of the Global Press Institute. Hegrinus starts by talking about the genesis of her nonprofit.
The story of Global Press really started back in the early 2000s, just after I finished my master's degree at NYU. I got my dream job. I got an overseas assignment as a foreign correspondent. And as my mother will tell you, I had been saying since I was about 6 years old that I wanted to be a journalist. And growing up, all I wanted to do was travel the world telling its stories. So I finally got the opportunity. I was a foreign correspondent covering the civil war in Nepal. And I was in country for about 9 days before I realized that the discipline of foreign correspondence is, it's really theater, and it's so inauthentic. And the people and the information you have access to are so filtered and controlled that I was really sort of both mad and heartbroken at the same time, feeling like everything I had ever wanted to do was not really meant for me. I came to the realization that I was the wrong person to be telling these stories. For example, to get a journalist visa, you had to agree to work through government-employed translators, and there were sort of buses that took foreign correspondents in the places where they were allowed to tell stories. So it was such a filtered and controlled version of the story. So the more time I spent in country, started just sort of breaking away from the typical stories, and started spending more time in rural communities, local communities, and slowly came to the realization that I had just two things. I had journalism training, and I was working for credible publications. But that was sort of where my expertise stopped. And these communities were filled with people, women in particular, who had such extraordinary context, social, historical, political, cultural context, that would allow them, if they had the opportunity to be journalists, this context would allow them to gather the facts that formed much more complete truths. But it all came together a few years later in 2006. I decided to take the step to quit my job. I was then a feature writer working for SF Weekly in San Francisco to start Global Press. And so since then, in the almost 11 and a half years since then, we have built an extraordinary new model for international journalism.
So when you were in Nepal and you had this realization that this was not the right structure, you were not the right person, was there someone or someones that you ended up speaking with who shared something with you that was kind of that trigger moment?
Yeah, absolutely. There was one woman in particular who was really, she was my lightning bolt. Her name was Pratima. I was in a rural village for a couple of days, and this woman was the matriarch of the village, and she was so incredible, and the story of this village was so incredible. And what was really interesting about it is the village was inhabited mostly by women, because the younger men in the village were taking part in the war. And then a lot of the older men in the village were working overseas in the Middle East or in India and sending back income. So it was this like very fascinating sort of cultural setup. And so I was just really intrigued by Pratima. And so I decided that I wanted to write a story about her. And by this time in Nepal, I spoke a little Nepali. Pratima spoke a little bit of English. But it's like, have you ever been in one of those conversations where, you know, you're trying to cross some cultural and linguistic boundaries, and you think if you speak like loudly and slowly, that somehow information will you know, transpire, which just didn't happen. And so, you know, I wasn't able to ask the questions that I needed to clearly, or she wasn't able to answer me clearly. And so finally, in a moment of frustration, I literally physically handed her my notebook and my pen, and I just said, you know what, you write it. Tell the story of this place that is not accessible to me. Talk to the people in your community who I can't speak to because I don't speak the language, or who won't talk to me because they don't trust me as just this random, you know, outsider. And so she took a couple of days to do it, and she sort of went around and did some interviews and asked some questions. And when I got back to Kathmandu, I had what she had written translated, and it was 100% a piece of journalism. It was the story of that place, because really what it means for the world to have extraordinary journalism from developing communities it's a really powerful prospect, right? Not only does it mean that as journalists, women are now being employed in positions of literate leadership, right? So too often around the world, we have the conversation about women's economic empowerment in terms of, you know, low-wage service professions, sort of the bracelets and the baskets and the food carts and things like that. So number one, if women were employed as professional journalists, especially in rural communities, they would be literate leaders in their community making living wages. The second area that I thought, you know, could really be transformed is that local people could have access to more authentic information. And then three, the world could have greater awareness about really, you know, these parts of the world where we get such stereotypical coverage from. So from that, you know, those few notebook pages of writing that Pratima gave back to me, it was really the thing that gave me a new vision for how international journalism could actually work.
So back then, when you were trying to start this up, what were some of the things that you ran into that were the most challenging or the most surprising that someone wasn't just jumping behind your idea?
I think that's the dirty secret of founding an organization. You know, I think 25-year-old Christy thought, this is going to be amazing. I'm just going to, you know, spend my life traveling around the world, training powerful, amazing women to be journalists. And then their journalism is going to change the world. And it's just going to be fun all the time. You know, this idea was really sort of out of the blue. And there's still to this day is a lot of resistance, you know, we need foreign correspondents. We need to know what, you know, Nick Kristof thinks about the Congo. And we need to know, you know, what Anderson Cooper thinks about Haiti after an earthquake. You know, I do not share those viewpoints, but it has been difficult to get people to pay attention to this model, in part because of the way mainstream media covers women in the developing world. Right. There is a dominant, almost sole victim narrative when it comes to who are women in Africa, who are women in rural Guatemala or, you know, Bangladesh. It is 100% a victim narrative. So when I'm then coming forward and saying, actually, the women that we are working with, and actually, I think the majority of women in developing communities are much more than this sort of two-dimensional poverty persona that we attach to women in developing communities. And so what I'm saying is, you know, not only are these women brave and bold for wanting to take up the craft of journalism, they are ambitious and they want to create change in their communities and they want to make money and, you know, all of these things that we don't typically think of when we think about women in the developing world. So that, I think, is a tough sell. But over the years, as our training model has, you know, gotten better and better and better, really the core aspect of Global Press that makes us successful is the training to employment model. So the fact that we offer long-term employment to 100% of the women who graduate from our training program means that our reporters are with us for the long term. Right? I mentioned our first ever office in Chiapas that started with four journalists back in 2006. Two of those four journalists are still with us. They still work for Global Press. So anyone who's ever, you know, been a journalist or been any sort of profession knows what you're doing on your first story versus what you're doing 11 years in is pretty dramatically different. And so, you know, our journalism has really sophisticated. The storytelling, you know, is powerful. We've really staked our reputation on the discipline of verification, accuracy, the four-tiered fact-checking process that every Global Press article goes through. So it was all a long journey to developing credibility in a field like journalism that loses credibility every day. We're trying to, you know, build a name for ourselves.
And do you look back when you were first starting this organization? I mean, are there any conversations with potential funders that stood out to you where they said, well, the reason that we're not going to do this is fill in the blank?
One of the most interesting things to me today in the funding space, that the biggest inhibitor for us when you ask what people say, you know, no to or the reason why, it remains. Somebody just told me no last week because of the gender component of our program. And I think that why women question is one that people are still, especially at some of the more mainstream foundations or news organizations, remain uncomfortable with. And so that has been really interesting to me, that over 11 years, that why women question is still sort of a deal breaker for some people.
Well, what about this narrative that the reporting about women in developing countries is always about how terrible things are going for women now, you know, the dark side of the story, and you're trying to bring to light these other stories and the successes and the things that are working? Do you find that women reporting are able to find those stories more easily, or because they're experiencing those stories, or what? Maybe you could give an example.
Sure. I mean, I think the victim narrative for women in the developing world is just insane. I mean, it is really, you know, Congo is the rape capital of the world, right? That is like the sort of one-line monikers that we know places. And so our reporters are definitely able to get beyond those sort of cliches. They're also able to get beyond the war, poverty, disaster, disease narrative that international media perpetuates. You know, and this is by no means, like, I'm not saying this is a good news channel, right? This is not a rose-colored glasses. Everything in Congo is easy and amazing. Our journalistic mandate is to provide long-term comprehensive coverage from the communities where we operate. So we talk with our reporters about what comprehensive coverage looks like. Every month we produce a comprehensive coverage report. So, you know, if conflict or human rights issues in Congo is 20% of daily life, we want that to be 20% of our storytelling. But we also have to remember that these are real communities filled up with real people who, you know, have needs around education and healthcare. And, you know, there are businesses and there are entrepreneurs. And ultimately, I think the driving force behind all Global Press stories is really this, the narrative that comes up sort of again and again is local people innovating to solve their own problems. And that's something that we see time and again, that our reporters are much better able to, you know, to tell. For example, this is sort of a funny example, but a couple of years ago, this big report came out, some international cellular provider that said, you know, there are now more cell phones than people in Congo. And the, you know, the narrative is like, oh, wow, like Congo must really be developing. Like, that's so great. There are more cell phones than people in Congo. And it sort of just became one of these, yet another just one-liner narrative. Well, our reporter did a story and she was like, well, of course there are more than, you know, of course there are more cell phones than people. You have to have more than one because, you know, 99% of Congolese people don't have electricity in their homes. And so you need multiple phones to keep one charged. So what she did sort of in response to that is she did a story about these local entrepreneurs who are creating pop-up generator shops where people could, you know, drop off their phone for a couple of hours in the afternoon while they had the other one and get it charged, then, you know, swap it out. And so the story really became, you know, this is not about just a quick tagline or a quick statistic that you can throw at a country like Congo. This is about real people on the ground who are innovating to solve their own problems, who are serving their communities and who are, you know, just gives a real slice of life about, you know, how people are living and what the realities of the situation is.
Well, I'd love to talk a little bit more about what you look for in the women who become journalists for you. Are there characteristics that you search for? Are they already doing it? What, if you could just share a little bit of context around what you found to be the sort of hallmarks of this woman is going to be a great pick to report in her country.
Yeah, there are so many things. I mean, there's definitely one in particular that I always look for. You know, in terms of background, the majority of our reporters have no prior experience in journalism, and we prefer that. One of the things that makes our journalism so different is that our international reporters are reporting at a global standard. That's often a criticism that people will throw at international journalists is, oh, they don't write at the same level or they don't have the same code of ethics or ethical standards, so we can't trust their reporting. Global Press reporters are trained to report and write and fact check at not only an industry standard, but above an industry standard. So in terms of background, they generally have no prior experience as journalists. So there's a lot of different indicators that we look for. Ultimately, for me, though, there's one question in the interview process where we ask people to imagine they were journalists first day on the job. What is a story that they would cover across the world? It doesn't matter if it's in Sri Lanka or in Mexico or, you know, in Zambia or wherever. One of three things always happens. One is a candidate will say, I would write about health. Or I would write about poverty, or I would write about education, right? These big, like, sort of blanket buckets. This is not really a story. It's like a huge, huge topic that couldn't even be an encyclopedia set. The second thing that happens is people will sort of regurgitate what has happened in local news recently. You know, I would write about the prime minister saying this, or I would write about, you know, anything that they may have heard in the news in the last, you know, couple of days. The third thing, and this is the Global Press person, is the person who doesn't answer the question. They ask a question or they say, you know, I've always wondered about this thing and I've never understood how that happened. So my first story, I would go and figure that out. where they say, you know, I've always been curious about, or I would love to, you know, figure out. And that's really the hallmark of a Global Press reporter. And something that Global Press has taught me is there are really two kinds of people in the world, people who sort of absorb the information that's given to them, and also people who walk through the world and they see stories there and they ask questions because they want to flesh out stories. I imagine that's sort of how I was as a kid and how I still am now, where if I see something that doesn't work or that I don't understand, I'm never willing to just write it off as like, well, that's a mystery. And I think that our reporters everywhere in the world really have that. And sometimes that leads our reporters into covering really sort of off the wall or taboo topics. One of our best reporters, her name's Prudence Fieri. She's in Zambia. And she covers the wildest stories. Like, she did a story last year that is still one of the most widely read stories on our website about the practice of dry sex, which is where women are buying these like salts and other products in the markets to intentionally like facilitate dry sex because that's the preference of men in Zambia.
So what do you see as the future of women in journalism? I mean, globally, but also here in the U.S.? Like, what would your dream be?
You know, I think this dream will become a reality sooner than later. And I'm not always sure why I'm still an optimist, but I somehow seem to be. I think that the power of women as journalists is an undeniable force that is sort of taking the world by storm, right? When you look at the percentage of women in journalism schools in the United States, and when you look at you know, the incredible, powerful feature and investigative work that journalists at Global Press and elsewhere are doing. Women have such a natural ability and affinity for storytelling that if we could just, at the mainstream and legacy media level, make room for them, not just in our newsrooms to be our storytellers, but also in leadership positions, that's really, I think, the biggest need. Right, the agenda setters, the people who decide how much time stories get and where we invest money and things like that, those are the jobs that news organizations really need to make room for women in. And I really do think that it will be an undeniable shift because, you know, at Global Press, we're certainly doing our part to demonstrate it, but women throughout the world, throughout, you know, the U.S., some of the best reporting that's been done on emerging social issues in the U.S. is being done, reported by female reporters and producers. And so I think it's just a matter of news organizations halting the conversation about, you know, diversity in the newsroom because it's the right thing to do, and actually understanding that the best newsrooms are going to have the most diverse body of reporters because that's the way you get the stories that your competitors can't get.
What's the best advice that you've ever been given about how to disrupt the mainstream?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really just boils down to persistence, right? It boils down to the persistent desire to make sure that change happens. And that's not always easy, but it is necessary. And I think we see that narrative sort of echoing more and more in America these days. And we also really see the narrative of persistence as one of the primary narratives that we should be telling about developing communities, as, you know, the persistent desire becomes a persistent demand for change. And that's really how anything good ever happens. So it's really exciting to be at the forefront of a movement to really change the way that international stories are told. And, you know, I can't say enough that the women of Global Press are absolutely the bravest, boldest, funniest, most ambitious, passionate women you'll ever meet. So I think I definitely derive my strength from them on a daily basis.
That was Kristi Hegrenes, founder and executive director of the Global Press Institute. She was speaking with Inflection Point host Lauren Schiller, produced at KALW in San Francisco. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1489.